accession number 28645, rule 21.
Now you said that you couldn't go to.
No.
Why was that?
Money. I hadn't got the money.
Because you were now living on a retirement pension.
On retirement, which was a good pension, but it didn't do big luxuries like that. I started my miniature painting. Got going on that.
When you started to live in Paris?
Yes. But my husband didn't altogether approve of that.
Why was that?
Well, it wasn't that he didn't. I think partly he was probably partly jealous I had something to do. And also, I don't know, when the bell went for lunch, if I didn't lay down my brush that instant, I got into trouble. You can't always lay down a brush at that instant.
So you still had staff to cook for you?
Yes, we had a Breton lady.
A Breton lady?
Yes, who did the cooking. Therese.
Came.
She lived with us.
And she moved, because she knew your family, she moved from...
That's right. Mm. So she did that and the housekeeping, and the marketing. She was a good soul, was Therese, very good. And not very well treated. Don't know, they just treated her almost like a piece of furniture.
Who by?
The family.
But not by you.
Well, Therese was Therese, and her place was the kitchen, and that was where she was used to being. And I don't know, there was a different attitude in those days. Anyway, and so I started my miniature painting.
Did what? Caused you to, throughout this, all these tapes, these many hours of tapes, one thing that seems to be clear to me is that you have a great artistic sensibility, a great awareness of your environment, especially what one could describe as of the natural world, flowers and such like. You are always describing fields of narcissi or whatever it may be, bougainvillea growing. What led you to start miniature painting? And I assume, was it miniature painting of floral subjects?
Yes, to begin with.
So what started the painting?
Well, the painting I've been doing since I was 8. Normal flower painting. But the miniatures I started... Did we do the... No, we didn't. That's a piece we haven't done.
What is it that we haven't done?
My return to... St. Wolfgang after the war, and that is pertinent to your question.
Would you like to slot that in now, and then we'll come back to my question?
Yes, we can do that.
I apologize for speaking up.
Wait a minute.
I'm speaking loudly because my microphone lost again, so I'm using yours.
Oh, right.
That's why I'm shouting at you.
Okay. You're recording at the moment, are you?
Yes, I am at the moment.
Oh.
Would you like me to pause?
Yes, let me collect my thoughts. We'll just say as soon as one could get a permit.
Which might have been...
To get through Austria.
Yes.
I told my husband that I wanted to go back and see what had happened to my friends in St. Wolfgang. And the White Horse Inn. It would be about November. It was autumn. So he got me a French permit, and I managed to get through Salzburg. And yes, that was a very strange journey. That was the one after the war. Yes, it was. So I got as far as Salzburg, and in the old days, there was a darling little train which went at about 20 miles an hour and went all the way along the lake and finished up in Bad Ischl and dropped one off at St. Wolfgang, which was a stage for a boat. Then you took a boat across to St. Wolfgang. That was the only way you could get there. So I found this train, got on it, and then they brightly told me it wasn't going farther than this end, the eastern end of the lake, in a little place called Strobel. So I got to Strobel, and I was stuck. The last bus had gone, and there was no way the train was going any further. And I was tipped out of the train, and I went across to the inn. And it was evening, there was a lovely sun shining, and there was a row of the elders of the village sitting along the bench drinking schnapps. So I, knowing my place in an Austrian village, sat down at a distance from them, because you didn't disturb the elders. So they looked at me with some curiosity, and then one of them, who was more friendly than the others, no, not friendly, they were friendly, but they were the elders, dash it. So one of them said, good evening, and what was I doing? So I explained to him my situation. He said, don't worry, something will come up. Come and join us. Now that was the greatest honour you could possibly get in an Austrian village, to be invited to join the elders. That was absolutely it. So I went over very humbly and sat down with the elders, and they were very kind to me. They said, don't worry, Fräulein, something will come. So I waited, and then suddenly a car drew up in the middle of the square. You see, he said, there's a car. So I said, there's no guarantees going where I'm going. So one of them went across and greeted the driver and said, where are you going? And the driver said, I don't care. So he said, oh, well, that's just fine. Would you like to take this girl to St. Wolfgang? He said, I don't care. I'll take her to St. Wolfgang if she wants to go. So he loaded me in and off we went. It's a very curvy road along the lake. He treated every corner as if it weren't there and as if he were a racing car. So I said to him, I think it'd be nice if we got there. Or don't you care? He said, no, I don't care. He said, I don't care in the least. Kill myself. So I said, yes, but I don't want you to kill me. Oh, well, he said, I'll try. So he went on dashing away at the corners, and then I looked at his hands, and he was minus quite a few fingers. I said to myself, concentration camp. And after that, I talked to him, and he said there were only two people on earth who were good. There were the unborn and the dead. He said he was just going to drive until he died. He didn't care for life anymore. He didn't care for anything anymore. So it was a very unhappy conversation. I tried to comfort him as far as I could, but nothing seemed to make any difference. We landed up at the White Horse Inn, and we booked in, and I tucked him up in bed like a small child and said good night and said I'd see him the next morning. And I duly went to bed, and I had a hunch that I'd better get up early, so I was up at 6, went down, the hall porter said, oh no, he left at 5. Terrible. Anyhow, there I was in St. Wolfgang, and I started doing some walks, and I walked up the mountain there. And I was in a small clearing where there weren't so many trees overhead and so on. And paused and looked around because the larches were looking beautiful. And suddenly I heard a whistle like a bomb. So I ducked, and an eagle passed over with its claws inches from my head. It had seen my head bobbing and thought I was something it could eat. And at the very last moment, it had seen my body and realized it couldn't. But it passed within about a couple of inches of my head. It was an extraordinary experience. I was nearly an eagle's dinner. Anyhow, so I stayed there, and it was really very sad. There were my friends who'd been killed, friends who hadn't come back.
Austrians?
Yes. And so then I went on to Genoa, because that was where I could get a ship to Egypt. And it was November, because all the persimmons were in fruit. And it was a wonderful sight. I went to drive round the countryside. And all these glowing orange fruits hanging on the trees with no leaves. Beautiful sight. And I boarded the Hesperia. And on the Hesperia, nobody liked persimmons except me, so I ate them out of house and home. I finished their store of persimmons on the way to Egypt. And I met a millionaire. And we duly sat at the same table and got quite friendly. And when we got to Egypt, he decided to come and visit, which he did. He sent me 12 dozen red roses. My husband didn't see eye to eye with that. And I promised that I would spend one day showing him round Cairo, you see, because he didn't know Cairo, so up I went to show him round Cairo. And midday he sent all the servants away, so I said, oh. So I very soon said, we must go and see the bazaar, and off we went. Much to his disgust.
He knew you were a married woman?
Oh, yes. He visited us.
So he really was quite a lounge lizard type of customer, in a way?
No, not necessarily. He was a man with a lot of money. Anyway, so I showed him Cairo. He behaved very nicely and all that. And going down one of the side roads, well, lanes, paths in the bazaar, we found a man sitting on the floor, and he was cutting up ivory tusks with his feet. They did it with a machine that they worked with their foot. So I was fascinated. I looked at this, and I thought, I wonder, can one paint on the stuff? So I made my millionaire buy me a set of pieces of this ivory, which I took off home, and that started me on painting on ivory. I've still got some of it in my studio.
So ivory was your first... I don't know what you call it, base,
yeah.
Yes, upon which you painted.
No, I've been painting flowers since I was eight, I told you.
No. I'm sorry. What I'm trying to say is, I'm trying to draw a distinction between when you were painting flowers since you were eight and when you started to paint, for want of a better word, seriously.
Well, I was experimenting with this ivory and watercolour. I'm learning how to paint miniatures of flowers. But I was still painting large flowers as well. Both.
You mean life size?
Mm.
Yes. What drew you to miniatures?
Because I loved ivory. I collected ivory. And I loved painting, and I thought, well, why don't I try it?
So, in other words, it wasn't the desire to paint miniatures. It was the fact that you had this particular interesting material to use, which by its natural form lent itself to miniature painting, and so that's why you did miniature painting. Would that be right?
Well, I knew about that miniatures existed, and I started by painting small flowers, so they were miniatures ipso facto. I didn't paint large flowers small, I painted small flowers.
Ah, thank you.
Yes, I was just thinking that it has always been in almost all my work. I've never made large flowers small, I've always painted small flowers, miniature flowers. And big flowers I painted their proper size. I painted the size always, as it naturally is. But you asked me how I started miniatures, and that is the end of the tale on how I started miniatures.
So by the time we come to Paris in 52, you have some expertise in this area.
Well, I was... I don't know about expertise. I suppose so, yes. I suppose so. Because in 54, I had an exhibition in London. So we're gradually coming over into the next section of life.
We are. So you must have, before, this might be a point if you're... I don't know how you feel. This might be a point shortly to stop then.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just ask you this question then. You're living in Paris with your husband who is retired, who doesn't have an alternative occupation, but then he is 65-ish, very nearly.
Yes, but he needed work.
But he needed work.
Mm-hmm.
In the space of 2 years, would it be correct, you produced enough work for an exhibition, or did you draw on what you had done before?
Well, I'd done some in Egypt.
Yep.
I suppose it must have been enough. Otherwise I wouldn't have done it. I think I had about 30 miniatures by then. And the big ones. But of course, the big ones weren't the qualities that I did later on.
The big ones weren't of the quality you did of large
no.
flowers. But so your technique greatly improved.
It did.
Well, shall we leave it then this afternoon with your first exhibition in London in 54?
Yes, I think that's a good stopping place. Because that's coming over into the next life, as it were.
Well, we'll stop here.
Right. How do you find all this? It seems to me sort of flat and uninteresting. I don't know.
No, it's not a question of whether it's flat or uninteresting. It's a question of can it be transcribed and will it be of value to you when you come to look at it?